Thank you, Peter, and thanks to the Open University of the Left and to the Chicago Public Library for giving us the space to actually have a public conversation. So I would much prefer to be discussing the social gains in Bolivia over the last 12 years. Just like the last time I gave a presentation on Venezuela, I would have preferred to be talking about the gains in Venezuela over the 20 years with the Chavistas in power, including literacy, healthcare, improvement in equality, quality of life. But it seems that the public interest mostly arises when there is an attack on progress. And so we are looking at Bolivia now after a coup that took place about a month ago. And it's, again, I assume many people know that there was a coup in Bolivia and know some of the details. And I would hope that we would be able to move on that to talk about lessons of the coup, how it was staged, what it means for us. But even just yesterday in the New York Times, there's an article buried in the front section that says, ex-president of Bolivia flies to Argentina. There's a lot of discussion about fake news, but it just struck me, this short little one-column article, I will just read you a couple clips. Mr. Morales was granted asylum in Mexico after his resignation in the wake of a disputed election which the Organization of American States said was rigged in his favor. That's just factually not true. You go down a little bit. Mr. Morales resigned as president on November 10th after the OAS declared there were serious irregularities during the October 20 election. Factually not true. Even if you read the OAS report, that's not in there. Prompting political allies to quit. Again, factually not true. And the army to urge him to step down. Go down a little bit, the two paragraphs from the end. Mr. Morales, who was the first indigenous president, insisted on seeking a fourth term in defiance of term limits and a 2016 referendum. Again, factually not true. If this person was a journalism student at Purdue Northwest, they would not pass the course. After he resigned, Jeanine Inez Chavez was appointed interim president. Factually, not true. The Bolivian, I'll give you a piece that is true. The Bolivian foreign minister, the one that has been appointed by Jeanine Inez, said that she hoped that Argentina would restrict Mr. Morales from making political statements. That's a true fact. Bolivia is trying to silence Morales, Linera, many of the others that were forced to resign. That's a factual statement. Anyway, I just want to give a quick recap of the November coup. Again, most of the details are knowable. Most of the details you can find out, even if you read the New York Times, some of the factual parts are there. There was an election on October 20th. Morales got 47% of the vote. His opponent, Mesa, and the conservative parties got 36% of the vote. Hence, Morales, according to the Constitution, was declared president. Immediately following, there were protests. It's important to note that these protests were organized by vigilante political gangs, vigilantes that were organized by civic groups, civic committees that are racist, that are and particularly virulent physical assaults on indigenous. And again, it's not something that I'm saying. I have a short piece here on the back. It's the number of sources. Some of those you can find. The U.S. State Department even wrote, the official in Bolivia wrote to the U.S. State Department in the United States and says this group, the Santa Cruz Civic Committee and the Youth Council of the Santa Cruz Civic Committee said that they are exceptionally racist and virulent in their attacks. So it's not my assessment, it's from the State Department itself. There was a police mutiny. The military and the police refused to intervene when these vigilante gangs began harassing, assaulting, brutalizing, even burning homes, kidnapping officials. The police and the military stood aside. At this point, General Calaman and a police general suggested to Morales that he resigned. Morales resigned, Linera resigned, the president of the Senate, the vice president of the Senate, the president and the vice president of the Chamber of Deputies all resigned under the same duress. In fact, overall, there were more than the number that I found was 68 local and regional movement towards socialism officials that had been elected resigned after physical attacks or threats to their families or having their offices burned. Furthermore, the legislatures that were elected in the 2019 October 20th election were barred from entering the National Assembly, and in protest, many of the others just boycotted the National Assembly. At this point, the second vice president, Jeanine Añez, declared herself president. Her party, by the way, won 4% of the vote in the election on October 20th. That's a coup. The military intervenes, the police intervene, vigilante gangs intervene, and the evidence also comes post-coup. Añez declared herself president. There were a total of 5 people in the room when she decided that she was president. The Constitution says there needs to be a quorum of the Senate, and first of all, they have to vote to accept the resignation of the outgoing president, so they never met, they never did that. And secondly, they would have to vote on the succession. The only people in the room, by the way, were the military, a couple other political party officials, and the church, and of course, Añez was carrying her Bible. She immediately granted immunity to police and army attacks against the protesters, said that there would never be any charges made against them. And in the aftermath, there's been at least 30 people killed, more than 700 wounded. Those are official figures. Hundreds were assaulted. The United Nations, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, even Human Rights Watch says that there was excessive undue force, and they've all expressed concern. Journalists have been expelled. Indigenous and international observers have either been jailed or expelled. 700 Cuban doctors were expelled. They issued an arrest warrant for Morales and others, and they issued warrants of sedition against many of the MAS elected officials. And Añez immediately contacted Bolsonaro in Brazil, Macri, who is now gone, but he was in Argentina, and Guaido, and of course her Bible, which she was allied with all of these. They invited back the U.S. Embassy, invited back the Drug Enforcement Agency, and invited back USAID. This is what it looks like when a privileged class attempts to defend its wealth and its power against democracy. Peter announced that this was a presentation on how to stage a coup, and I would give you a list as long as you don't use it or share it with anybody. How to stage a coup. Number one, recruit and fund an opposition in the name of democracy. That can be civic groups, it can be NGOs, it can be the media. Number two, begin a media slander, disinformation, propaganda campaign with the local media. Number three, organize disruption, particularly using university students from the wealthy, the middle class, organized in civic groups. Failing all else, you buy or bribe support. In this case, it would be the Organization of American States or the Lima Group, which was a breakaway from the OAS a few years ago when the U.S. did not have its particular interest being answered. They formed a kind of a rump OAS. I'm not sure if it even exists anymore because since that time, there's been many changes in the representation in the Organization of American States. Internationally, you misinform the public with frames of fear, with frames of threats to democracy and human life, and with frames of humanitarian values. And then you plan and respond to this crisis that has been organized and launched with a new post-coup government that has declared the restoration of democracy. And throughout it all, if it's not so obscure, you deny any U.S. involvement at all. Again, I had, for those of you that are here, a list of Latin American coups against democracy only over the last 50 or 60 years. You can see there's been something on the order of 20 elections, democratic elections, that have been followed in short order by coups, in almost every case assisted, recognized, if not given even more support by the United States. So the past is our present. One of the things I'd like to stress is that this was not just a coup against Morales or a coup against the movement towards socialism, MAS, the political party, but it was a coup against democracy. We need to think about this. In 2006, there was an election. Morales won the presidency. The Movement for Socialism won representation in the Senate, 54% of the vote. In 2008, the people that organized the coup against Morales organized a referendum under the Constitution for his recall. He won that vote, 67%. In 2009, there was a constitutional reform that the entire population in Bolivia voted for. The constitutional reform was approved with 61% of the population. In 2009, Morales and Mas again won 64% of the vote, an astounding victory. In 2014, Morales and Mas still won 61% of the vote. Just this past October, Morales won 47% of the vote, which made him the president under the Constitution, and the Senate, the Mas members that ran for Senate, won 58% of the vote. Let me repeat, Jeanine Añez's party got 4%, and she declared herself president after the majority had voted for Mas representation in the Senate. So why was there a coup? The capitalist class had lost to the social movements in every popular election that has been held in almost the past 20 years. They've lost. The capitalist class lost, 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 lost. Neoliberalism was pushed back. Privatization was pushed back. Attacks on indigenous and racism was pushed back. Austerity was pushed back. The capitalist class lost to popular social movements in Bolivia. 20 years of defeats, from the water wars in Cochabamba in 2000, to the gas wars in El Alto in 2003, to the elections, to the recalls, to the Constituent Assembly, to the constitutional vote, to Morales being elected in 2019. I would suggest this should not be a surprise to us. It wasn't even really secretive. I understand it's done with euphemisms, but it's not a conspiracy per se. The Bolivian media and Mesa, who was running against Morales, were already saying in the summer of 2019 that this election is fraudulent and will not be respected. After the OAS gave their stamp of approval to Morales running, the OAS said yes. He's a legitimate candidate. He has the right to run. This is a good election. Mas ran Morales. He was the legitimate candidate. He won the election. 3 months prior, the Santa Cruz Civic Committee, the Bolivian media, said that this election will not stand. So, why a coup? They lost. You can't put it to a popular vote. You lost. The only way left was a violent replacement of the democratic will of the population. There's a piece by Stan Smith in the Council of Hemispheric Affairs that goes over 12 years of progress in Bolivia. As I said, I would prefer that we were talking about some of the social gains that happened in the last 12 or 13 years in Bolivia. Including a new constitution that nationalizes oil and gas production for the benefit of Bolivians, that passed land reform. In fact, 134 million acres have been distributed to the indigenous. Talk about reparations. Talk about returning of theft. 134 million acres. The constitution says no one can singularly own more than 12,000 acres. That's the law. Economic growth in the last decade has been almost 5%. They've reduced extreme poverty by 50%, according to the World Bank. Built 4,500 new schools, primarily primary education. The United Nations recognized Bolivia in 2008 or 2009, having wiped out illiteracy. They passed a universal monthly pension for people over 60. They have recognized indigenous rights and 37 different languages in Bolivia. Healthcare, access to the media, defense of the environment, all of these things have been the result of the movement towards socialism, being elected to office, organizing popular assemblies, organizing candidates for office. The Constitution itself is remarkable for its the way that it has expressed participatory democracy, which gives rights to both popular assemblies, allows for a referendum, which Morales stood for recall. It also sets aside a third of the media outlets for community radio and indigenous radio, and a third for the public, and a third that are private. They've never reached that, but nonetheless, it certainly irritated the people in Santa Cruz when you would have someone like Sonia Sinanye, who's from the St. Gabriel Community Media, interviewing Tupac Katari Congress, which is a Congress of the Amira, and it's broadcast to the country in the Amiran language without saying blessings to God. That was quite disturbing to the Santa Cruz Civic Committee. I have a picture. I don't know if you can see it from here, but you can find this online. It's easy enough to find the Santa Cruz Civic Committee and UJC, which is the youth group of the Santa Cruz Civic Committee. It's not for nothing that their salutes are very emblematic of the Nazi salute, or their slogan, their slogans and their activities. So, what do we have with the nationalizations that began to take place after 2006 and really move forward after 2009 with the constitutional amendments? Forbes says that Bolivia's growth in 2018 was over 4%. Unemployment was below 4%. The IMF in 2015 said that the reduction of inequality and poverty in Bolivia is dramatically better than all of Latin America. I'm not saying these things. This is what the World Bank, Forbes, and the IMF is saying. The Financial Times said that they have tripled the size of the economy with record foreign reserves. They did this all against neoliberalism, against privatization, against extraction for profit for the multinationals. $3,400 per person is the GDP. I would just ask us to step back here. I'm talking about Bolivia, but let's step back just for a second and compare this to Nigeria, the most resource-rich, most populous country in Africa. The average per person GDP is 2,000, about half what it is in Bolivia. The unemployment rate is between 12 and 20%, depending on the age. It's much higher for the youth. There are 112 million people living in poverty. 10 million students don't go to school. Multinationals are making money in the bucket loads. But you will not read anything in the New York Times or see it on the nightly ABC News or hear the Democrats in Congress wringing their hands about the lack of democracy, the lack of equality, the problems in Nigeria. Instead, they're threatened by, they truly are threatened by, not socialism. They're threatened by a movement towards socialism. It was a capitalist country. Movement towards socialism, but rejected austerity, rejected neoliberalism, the market, rejected the IMF, kicked out USAID, stopped the market making determinations over how they would proceed. Nationalized natural gas, mining, lithium, indium. Pull out your cell phone. That cell phone does not function without indium. Indium, 70% of the indium in the world is in Bolivia. And the Canadian mining company thought it was theirs until the people passed a constitution that says, no, it's ours. We'll be happy to work with you. Expanded democracy, expanded social programs. The highest growth and the biggest reduction of poverty on the continent. Neoliberalism was being defeated. That's why there was a coup. I also want to step back just for a second. This may not be the appropriate place to do it, but I want to ask us to learn some lessons from this coup. The capitalist class will never accept democracy. The capitalist class will never negotiate. You cannot appease, negotiate, make a deal with, even if it's a social democracy, if it includes reforms that are socially just. That will not appease capitalism. They will immediately turn to sabotage and disruption. Lesson number two, elections are insufficient to advance democracy. You win the presidency. You've won every election for 20 years in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Nicaragua, except for one. Coups against elections are followed by a post-coup sanitized election, as we saw twice in Haiti. And not only will the capitalist class not accept democracy, not only will they ignore elections, but they will use as much violence and attacks as necessary. Just as an aside, I'd ask you to think, Morales got 47% of the vote. His opponent got 36. Trump got 46%. His opponent got 47. Trudeau got 33%. His opponent got 34. Which election is being contested in the U.S. media? Before I talk about U.S. intervention, I want to stress that this was also a Bolivian capitalist coup. For 500 years, the colonists have ruled Bolivia with racism, exploitation of resources for more than 500 years. The austerity, the privatizations, the repression that came against the indigenous and the working class did not just start in 2019. It goes back to 1998, to 2000, to 2003, with the water wars, the privatization, and the natural gas wars, the privatization. There were violent protests in 2008 when the capitalist class in Santa Cruz, they call it the Half Moon. It's a series of provinces that are on the east side of Bolivia, excuse me, where many of the natural resources are, but it's where the wealthy live. They tried to organize for secession, essentially. We'll be our own country, or we'll at least be autonomous. We'll make our own deals with international trade. And there were violent protests, including assassination attempts against Morales in both 2008 and then after the Constitution was approved in 2009. These are organized disruptions. The Santa Cruz Civic Committee and the Santa Cruz Youth Union and civic committees in some of the other major cities are organized. They have training sessions. They have workshops. They have finance. They have T-shirts. I mean, it's not a sudden appearance, but it's something that's been in process for many years. The head of the UJC, the Santa Cruz Civic Committee and Youth Group, for a long time was Luis Camacho. Some of the websites that talk about him or some of the remarkable things that come from the U.S. State Department refer to him as a Christian fascist, known for attacks on indigenous workers, women, and mas. And I should say, even though the Constitution changed the allocation of signals for electronic broadcasting, the print is primarily in the private hands. Bolivian media has always been opposed to the movement towards socialism and indigenous rights. Through disruption, through sabotage, through violence, through the autonomy separatist movement. That's the backdrop to how a country like the United States can intervene, because it isn't an intervention against the entire population. There's a section of the population, the capitalist class, that own the land, that own the natural gas resources, that ask to work with the United States. Should note that the Bolivian military has always been trained at the U.S. School of the Americas. USAID gives between $10 and $20 million annually to non-government organizations. There's close to 200 in Bolivia. The U.S. ambassador supported and advised the right-wing protests for secession in 2008. The National Endowment for Democracy. Again, you can look these many of these things up for yourself, but the National Endowment for Democracy on their website report that they gave in 2018 $1.3 million to a variety of non-governmental organizations in Bolivia. The CIA, in October of this year, the election in Bolivia, released 68,000 WhatsApp posts on democracy and the election fraud and why Morales was not a suitable candidate. The United States Department of State hired a group called CLS Strategies to launch a PR campaign against Morales in his reelection in late 2019. Petrobras from Brazil, Repsol from Spain, and the Canadian mining company have all sued Bolivia in international court for reparations and their attempt to recover what used to be their primary profits. And then we add to all this the Organization of American State that before the elections were even over were challenging the validity of the elections, but not in their actual report. And to date, as far as I know, there has been no Organization of American States audit of the election. You can find this online, the report that they did issue. It's maybe 30, 40 pages. But the most they come up with is there's technical inadequacies in the reporting. There is no finding. In fact, their finding was we could not validate nor non-validate the election outcome, which is not exactly a claim that there was gross negligence or there was fraud. Okay, I'm going to give you another list. Let me see if I can go back and find how to stage a coup. Think about this. Recruit and fund the opposition for democracy, 200 non-governmental organizations. Media propaganda, slander, disinformation, which was primarily Bolivian media, willingly participating in that. Organizing disruption with students and middle-class activists, which was the Santa Cruz Civic Committee and other civic committees. Buy or bribe allied support, which I would say is the Organization of American States, and sometimes groups outside of that. There is a publication, Orinoco Tribune from Venezuela, that has recently they did a whole map of power. And they actually show on the map the connections between the U.S. State Department or the Santa Cruz Civic Committee and the National Press Association, FIDES, which is a Catholic Press Association, other groups. And you can see the relationships between each of them. So when we talk about buying or bribing allied support for the coup, the map that you can see on the Orinoco Tribune's website gives you some idea. And then misinform the public with threats, and you respond to the crisis with a post-coup government, which is what we got with Jeanine Añez. I'm going to offer you one more thing, how to cover the coup. If you happen to be a journalist for commercial media, how to cover a coup. And I would suggest this is what was done in 2002 when the coup was conducted against Chavez. This is what was done in Haiti in 2000 against Aristide. This is what was done against Zelaya in Honduras in 2009. And this is what was done in 2019 against the elections in Bolivia. Number one, blame all problems on the government. If there aren't problems, you create problems. Blame all problems, real or created, on the government. Don't think about sanctions. Don't think about the violent campaign for autonomy. Don't think about the non-governmental organizations that are organizing opposition, both written and actions against the government. But all problems that exist are blamed on the government. Number two, frame the leader as an autocrat, as a dictator, as a bureaucrat, as someone that wants more power. Number three, to more or less extent, insists that the leader is a puppet. Maybe Russia, certainly Venezuela or Cuba, right? We saw that in Honduras. Zelaya was a puppet for Chavez, right? Morales is a puppet for Chavez, or maybe Morales, I don't know. Bus driver using a cocoa farmer as a puppet, that's a whole... There's a meme there somewhere, I'm just saying. Don't use the word coup. Ridicule, or better yet, obscure any claims of U.S. involvement. frame the coup leaders, those that conducted the coup, as democratic, as restoring order. So Jeanine Añez in the New York Times becomes a proud Christian. Wall Street Journal says she's a salsa-loving baseball fan. Washington Post says she's captured the heart of a nation. Time says she's a women's rights activist. So you frame the people that just conducted a coup and gave permission to the military to beat and shoot with impunity as a proud Christian, which may be true. Then you blame the deposed leader for their own overthrow. So if someone was overthrown, it's their own fault. So if we take this, how to cover a coup, which I think we could have learned in some time ago, but over the course of the 50 years of that history of elections followed by military coups, you could probably follow how the New York Times, the Washington Post, ABC News, the rest have covered it. How did that happen in Bolivia? Number one, Morales was framed as an autocrat, a strongman, disregarded term limits, stuffed the court. New York Times. Bolivia's leader resigns, heeding protesters' call. The end of tyranny. Morales is gone, the end of tyranny. His populist legacy is marred by an attempt to keep power. New York Times. I can't give you the whole, I'm not going to break down every paragraph and every, I'll share this with you. But Bolivia's strongman. You go down the list to find out that he stuffed the Supreme Court, which is actually an elected body. Number two, elections. The OAS claimed they were corrupt, fraudulent, and there were technical miscounts. Was there a coup? No. Morales resigned. Downfall. Left a vacuum. The senator filled a vacuum. There was no coup. It was just a vacuum. He's gone, right? In this article, they say he fled to his hideout in the coca fields, like some vermin or something. There's a social crisis, but how do you present that? The New York Times says there was looting and vandalism by MAS supporters who were really just delinquents. That's how the New York Times reported. People that did not like the fact that we just had an election. We just elected our people to Congress, to the Deputy of Chambers, to the presidency. They've been pushed out of office. We don't think that's good. They have peaceful demonstrations. They get attacked by the Santa Cruz Civic Committee and others, and the police stand by or participate in it. Those are looters. Those are delinquents, according to the New York Times. And how do they present? The coup leaders? MAS Congress resigned, it was constitutional, it was orderly, democracy returns to Bolivia, and new elections are coming. I'm not going to go into the details, but there's a few ways that the New York Times and journalism in general is able to do this. I had a presentation similar to this at a university recently, and one of the students says, well, how can you possibly know? You know, there's different sites and stuff. But I would say one of the ways you can tell is you look for active or passive verbs. You don't have to be a grammarian to know that the army killed 8 versus people die in clashes. MAS clashed with police, 8 die. Dangerous clashes, 8 killed. In other words, there's nobody responsible. It's from these clashes, and we aren't even sure who it came from. Maybe if we have a short discussion, we can do a fact check on some of these claims that are in the New York Times in particular, because I have the papers in front of me. So, how to stage a coup, recruit an opposition for democracy, media propaganda, slander campaign, organize disruption, misinform the public, and then respond to the coup with a post-coup government. The post-coup government means you install a post-coup government, you launch a military crackdown on the public protests, you persecute, jail, kill any social movement members. They've kicked out Telesur. They closed the largest Bolivian community media station. They've arrested Argentinian independent journalists that came to cover the post-coup activity. You announced new elections, but you've already said that Morales and everybody that resigned is not eligible. In fact, Añez says maybe nobody in MAS will be eligible to run. And the media frame all of these events as favorable to democracy. Again, I would say this is not new. The past is present. I would say that this is not a surprise. The capitalist class will not give up power because that's what the majority wants. But it does pose a question for us, because not only is the past present, but the present is our opening to the future. And the question is, what can we do? What is the tasks for those people that are in favor of democracy or some of these gains for social justice? It's very clear to me, and it should be very clear from the history of U.S. involvement since the Monroe Doctrine, 200 years, is U.S. out of Bolivia, U.S. out of Venezuela, U.S. out of Latin America. Should be no aid to coup governments. If you want to talk about impeachment, it is against U.S. law to aid governments that have come to power following a military coup, including Sisi in Egypt, including Honduras, including Bolivia. There's an impeachable offense. You're not likely to find that because the Democrats happen to support that. But no aid to coup governments, stop funding USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute. Now, how do we do this? If there's something lacking, it is not the response of the majority of the world's population against neoliberalism, or I would argue, movement towards socialism. Right now, today, there are millions protesting in Colombia, Chile, Bolivia, France. You could almost pick the country where there are movements towards democracy. Not in the U.S., but that does not mean that we despair. How do we do this? I think that we do more public meetings like this. We have more discussions. We dispel any confusion people have about media distortions. We continue to speak in favor of progress and the democratic gains that have been made. I would venture to guess that most people cannot find Bolivia on the map. And even the people that can find Bolivia on the map do not know that it's the fastest growing, most equitable economy in all of the continent. If you want to write a letter to your congressman, fine, but I would encourage you to write more letters to your neighbors, write more letters to your unions, write letters to your city councils, to your churches, to any group you're in. Have a discussion like this. I would be more than happy to come to three or more people and have the same discussion with you. So if you wanted to organize a house meeting, we should do that. Get resolutions to support democracy against U.S. intervention. The Canadian Postal Workers, a small union, 54,000 people, but they passed a resolution against U.S. and Canadian intervention, which helps to undercut whatever authority a president that was elected by only 33% of the vote might have to speak for the population of Canada. In other words, share this information. I have a PowerPoint that I couldn't use here, but I'm more than happy to give that to anyone that would like that PowerPoint for their own community or your own group that you can use. And we need to draw these lessons for Bolivia, but for ourselves. There is no compromise with capitalism. There is no compromise or reform. We need more conscious movement towards socialism in the United States, which I think as we enter the election year, we need to think about that carefully. But in all of that, we must insist that the U.S. get out of Bolivia, get out of Venezuela, get out of Latin America. No aid to those coup governments, and stop funding USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy. and support the right of the population in any country to determine their own future. I know there's many things that we could discuss in more detail, so anybody that wants to have comments or questions, I think we have time to do that now. So.
Morales' government was in power for what, like 11 years, something like that?
From 2006.
They couldn't see this coming? Taken measures to prevent this from ever occurring. I would like you to maybe address that, speak to that point. My understanding is Bolivia is like 85, 90% indigenous population. The overwhelming majority of the people that are there are not Indo-Europeans.
It's a continual problem, I think. The capitalist class, when they have state power, it doesn't just mean they have the military and the police. They also have the entire educational system. They have the entire commercial system. They have the entire political system. So the entire 20th century, that means the capitalist class in this country and in Bolivia and other countries, there is no BA or MA or PhD for socialism. There is an MBA. There is a PhD in political science, which is much more political than it is science. There is a PhD in economics. There's advertisements every day. Even if you don't watch television, the millennials, by the time they're millennials, have seen more than 500,000 commercials. There are public relations people, like the group that the CIA hired to do a PR campaign in Bolivia. They have NGOs. There are no non-governmental organizations in the U.S. financed by Bolivia and Venezuela. That would be outside interference. Yes. That's a difficulty. I mean, I think it's, in my mind, it's amazing that the movement towards socialism goes as far as it does without having a more conscious class understanding. That's not something that you just pick up. I think your point, Robert, about the population, 67% of the population is indigenous. But that's not the only interesting fact. They have 36 different languages. That means there's 36 different nations in Bolivia, with not 36 different school systems, institutions, passing out PhDs in social change and social justice. So where is the population supposed to learn how to respond for this? Basic humanity says, if you see another person, I want to be reasonable. I'm going to be nice to them. I'm going to talk to them. That permeates, right? You have to really go a long ways, which is, I guess, Jeanine Añez has made it that far, or maybe our own president. I mean, when she got elected, she says, no more Pachamama in parliament. All those Satanists that are barefoot can go back to the Chaco, right? They're out of here. They're gone. Go back where you belong. But all the people from there thought, well, look, we have an election. We get elected. We have a constitution. We got to vote for the constitution. We have cholitas that aren't standing on the street. They're actually in Congress now. This is good. Let's talk. Let's work with these people, all with good expectations, not understanding the nature of capitalism in Bolivia or the nature of capitalism on a global scale. So I'm impressed that the movement towards socialism got that far with Pachamama, which actually has many of the same features of socialism because it's collective, it's cooperative, it's collaborative, it's for humanity. So they may not have read, you know, a Marxist tract or a Leninist thing of what is to be done, but many of those things were done. I would suggest that Venezuela, in my estimation, is somewhat different. I mean, Venezuela moved towards communes. Venezuela moved consciously towards 21st century socialism. Maduro announced this past month that they now have more than 3 million people in the militias that are now a permanent part of the Venezuelan military, not as an adjunct, but a permanently division within the Venezuelan military. And I think that comes because Chavez and the people around him in the Bolivarian 500 movement way back in 1998 actually did study history, did study things like the events in Chile. But at the same time, if you're in the leadership of a country like Bolivia or Venezuela, and you know there is no compromise with the capitalist class or with the oil companies or with the banks, and you know that the only way to protect the interests of the population is to control foreign trade, control the banking institutions, control the production. We do that on Tuesday. What happens on Wednesday? Right? I mean, you recognize what happened in Cuba. So to make that call that you know must be done, even in the case of Chavez or Maduro, means all hell's coming down. So there's a tendency to try not to get to that point till you're ready. But I think that's a balance, because at what point is the population ready versus at what point is the leadership ready? I know in the case of Nicaragua, the Sandinistas in 79 said, we've gone as far as we can, it's time to retreat, there is no revolution on the order of the day, and they backed. Largely women said, hell no. Largely women that were armed said, we're getting rid of the National Guard today. And the Sandinistas kind of recouped and said, okay, if the people are fighting, we're going to go out and protect this movement. And they got rid of Somoza. But that wasn't even the Sandinista call. It was a call from the popular movement. And I would say that's what happened in Venezuela. Chavez kidnapped, Chavez coup, Chavez taken to another island, right? I mean, he's done. But the population comes down and say, no, this can't go on. The interesting thing was the military in Venezuela, which was not trained in the School of the Americas, had more connection with the population than the military in Bolivia. That was a decisive factor. In Bolivia, the people came down just like they did in Venezuela. But when they got there, there was no section of the military or the police that was in their defense. In fact, they're like walking into a... Is that a mistake? Is that an error, miscalculation? I can't say from afar. But it's a different relation of social forces than was in Venezuela. But it's not the final. It's not the final call, I would say. I hope that speaks.
I am a full-time anti-nuclear activist. I wanted to tell you what happened in Ohio. Nuclear power in Ohio is called Entergy. And Entergy has both nuclear and coal-burning plants. They forced through a thing called HB6, which cut back on the amount of renewables that they were going to be able to get by some far distant date like 2050, and they cut back on the amount of money that is going to be done for renewables, and they established a $1.8 billion bailout for energy for two nukes and two coal-powered plants. There was a referendum on this, and the referendum signing period was 90 days. The Ohio Supreme Court took 35 days out of that 90 days, and then when the people went out to have the petition signed, there were multi other petitions that and many, many warnings not to sign a particular petition that came on advertising. And this is something I actually saw, an ad that said the people who were passing out these petitions were under the influence of China, and China was going to take over the electrical system in Ohio, and it was just the grossest, stupidest ad. How could anybody even have taken it seriously? Then they took sense of bugs out, and they started attacking. There was one person who was doing petitions, and he was being harassed. And so he dialed 911 on his cell phone, and the person who was harassing him came up and knocked his cell phone out of his hand and broke it. The kind of stuff that is going on that Lee has explained to us today goes on in the United States, in Ohio, on a smaller scale and specifically directed at the energy system in Ohio. But the reason that energy was able to pull this off is that the Ohio electorate had already been thoroughly gerrymandered by the Republican powers in Ohio. So that even though many more than half of people in Ohio vote Democratic, their Senate is much more than half Republican because of the way the places were gerrymandered. This is a problem in democracy that is right on our doorstep.
Thank you for that, because part of what's taking place in Bolivia, to me, is an indication of one of the things that she's making a point about Ohio. Capitalism is in crisis on a global scale. Neoliberalism, the attempt to privatize and commercialize everything, is in crisis because it no longer has mass support. Austerity does not exactly win friends. The fallback is nationalism, right? Italy wants nobody that isn't Italian to be gone, right? Brexit is about national identity. Nationalism in Bolivia is at a different level because nationalism in Bolivia meant equality for the population. But in this country, nationalism is just the opposite. And I say that because one of the lessons I suggest we understand is not just that the capitalist class won't give up power for democracy that has even a smattering of social justice, means they aren't going to recognize elections either. But they will use elections. If there is an illusion in this country, the biggest illusion is that you get a Democrat in office, we will be better off. That's the biggest, and it's just historically inaccurate. Obama was president. There was a coup in Egypt. Obama was president. They invaded Libya. Obama was president. There was a coup in Honduras. Obama was president that passed the executive order that says Venezuela is a threat to the U.S. Obama passed the GCC, Global Crisis thing, in December, a month before Trump takes office, that gives the executive the authority to do the kinds of things that USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy, does without reporting to anybody. That's one executive order that Trump didn't say was a problem. Obama gave him that authority. So we go down the list. You're right about Hillary Clinton. What I would say is it's not true that she could have done anything different. Yeah. It's not possible for the people that get elected to office in the Democratic Party to do anything different. It would be like saying, I don't want a giraffe to grow a tall neck. It's going to grow a tall neck. The Democratic Party is going to support intervention. Look at Sanders. Look at AOC. Look at Warren. It's the same, top to bottom. There's nuances, but that's not the same as being different. And that's the threat that Bolivia and Nicaragua and Venezuela have posed. That's why I think we have an obligation. If we're at all interested in what we want to happen in our lives here, we have an obligation to allow a little petri dish of opportunity to develop somewhere else so we can see what can grow in a culture different than ours. Look what they did in Venezuela. Look what they did in Bolivia. The U.S. growth the last few years has been 2%. Historic unemployment low, right? Yeah, but what's the average wage? We haven't reduced inequality by poverty by more than 50%. There's hope there. We need to learn from that, recognize that, and draw the lessons from that. If there's anything that needs to happen, is we have a responsibility to allow them to have more space so that the step doesn't come down on their neck because it's coming from here.
Can you comment, if you care, on these techniques that were used against Morales and started long before this issue of the current election? and the similarity with the vilification still of Corbyn in England,
yeah.
And how constant repetition of false claims, etc.
Well, it's a long story. The United States' involvement in Latin America has been really stepped up after World War II. But in the case of Bolivia, in the 50s, the United States opposed the whole movement towards socialism in the 50s. It was led by the miners, and they got a democratically elected government. They had very progressive measures. The U.S. was instrumental in a variety of coups that took place, including probably the one that was the most drastic and most influential was the Banzer in 1971, which left a dictatorship in power for more than two decades. So the U.S. has done this consistently. You're right, this is not new. Many of the things that you read in the North American Committee on Latin America or Jacobin or something will say, well, this started in 2016 when Morales overreached because he wanted to be able to have no term limits, and that vote was lost. And so therefore, he's extended himself too far, which is one of the things I say about media, blame the victim. So their response is, well, Morales shouldn't have done that. He should have known better. And if he hadn't have overstepped, then they wouldn't have been this coup. So it's his own fault for overstepping and not being democratic. Leaving aside the fact that the Supreme Court, which was elected, says that's unconstitutional to say you can't. Leaving aside the fact that in both Canada and the UK, there are no term limits, but we don't holler on democratic countries at Canada or the UK. So you're right. This is not a new phenomenon. It's a consistent modus operandi. The difference is that in the 70s and 80s, before that period, the U.S. was not did not find it difficult to send troops, like to the Dominican Republic or to Nicaragua or to Cuba. That was not a problem. Now it becomes more difficult, but it's like the question that earlier that said they have learned from their mistakes, their own overreach. It's best to have the appearance of local national groups that are fighting for democracy and then come to their aid. Or it's better to have non-governmental organizations that will be fighting for indigenous rights or the rights of women. One of the things I didn't point out is that Ivanka Trump went to Argentina the same week the coup took place with $200 million in aid to some Argentina women's group, and they mobilized a train that went from small town all the way to the Bolivian border. I don't want to make any conspiracy or overstate that, but the more important thing to me is that she shows up with $200 million for a women's group. This is a better way to intervene than it is to, right? If people consent, if they participate, if they think that it's in their interests, you're better off than saying, no, 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 you can't do that, and if you do that, we will repress you. It's better if people participate in their own inequality from the point of view of the rulers, not ours.
Legitimated.
Yes. And the media is very good at that legitimation. Because how do we, it's like the previous person said, not an expert in Latin America, not an expert in Egyptian politics or Syria. You can't be an expert in these areas, right? But state departments in every country, every major country, has experts in those areas, including experts in how to influence or advise, train in democracy. And that media, then, there's probably a book, I don't know, there should be a book, How to Cover a Coup. And I just gave you the way you do it. Blame the problems on whoever it is, Aristide, Morsi, whoever. Say that these people are fighting for democracy. Identify the humanist of the post-coup leaders. Obscure U.S. intervention. We're talking about Latin America, but a few days ago they released the Afghanistan Chronicles, I think. It's like, well, for 18 years, the United States has been at war in Afghanistan, and everything every military person said for the 18 years was a lie.
Wait a second. Are you talking about Afghanistan, or are you talking about Vietnam?
But the point is, again, any competent journalist would know that. But they aren't supposed to report it that way. They report in a way that says, you know, there is progress being made. There's difficulty. We have to go. It's like, yes, there's lots of euphemisms. And it's not hard to do. Language is a wonderful thing to clarify and explain and to highlight what we understand. It's also a very potent thing to confuse and disorient and misdirect. I mean, even the fact when somebody says, well, that's misinformation, it's a lie. That's disinformation, it's a lie. But somewhere journalists are told you can't say it's a lie. So misinformation seems like, well, that's just the way people do business. That's how you run for office. You have to feed them misinformation, public relations. You're right, it's not something new, but I would say it has become more refined and it has become more acceptable or tolerant for the general public. So when you have a thing, even when the U.S. has spec ops, special operations in Niger, what the hell are you doing in Niger? Well, that's not the important point. Is there spec ops and people were doing it and somebody missed their signal? And so it becomes almost like a superhero movie, not a commentary on... Right? Like I read to that piece, the Bolivian minister says, we want Argentina to silence Morales. It should be outrage. Well, no, that's, you know, of course they want to be. You know, it just becomes normalized. And that's, I think, is the big obligation that we have to bring this to the general publics, to your neighbors, to your friends, that this is not normal. This should not, it is normal. But it should not be allowed to be normal. We should say no to this. And it's not that complicated to learn how to do it.
I have a very quick question and then a very personal story. The quick question is, I heard that in the Bolivian Constitution, the environment itself had rights.
I'm not familiar with the details of the entire Constitution. I do know that in general, the indigenous conception of Pachamama, which is Mother Earth, says that we need to respect the relationship between humanity and nature, and we need to be able to respect nature's contribution to our existence. The specific details or the regulations that might enact that, I can't speak to it. But in general, your observation is yes. It's kind of it's even like the flag, the Wafala flag, or even the Constitution. It's called a plurinational constitution, so it means that there's multiple nations within the society. So in that sense, the question would be, well, how does that get enacted? That's always a question. It's one thing to have a law. We have laws in this country that say police shouldn't shoot black men. But very seldom are those laws enforced by anybody. So.
And for our eighth grade trip in 1970, when I was age 13, we went to Washington, D.C. And when we went to Washington, D.C., one of the things we did, we went to the Marine Memorial, that representation of these four men in bronze, sit on what's called in architectural terms a drum, cylinder, that's used for support. And on this granite drum were engraved all the places where the Marines had been sent in history. And I looked at this drum, and this engraving was done very nice in Roman capitals, great Roman capitals painted. And I looked at it, and I saw that the Marines had been sent somewhere in the Revolutionary War and in the War of 1812. They've been sent somewhere in the Mexican War or the Civil War, and they pretty much hadn't been sent anywhere else until we get to the turn of the 19th and 20th century. And all of a sudden, there are all these places and dates of where the Marines had been sent that I'd never heard of. Wars I was not familiar with. Wars in the middle of Central and sometimes South America.
that took up as much room as the, this is in 1870, took up as much room as the entire rest of the places and dates where the Marines had been sent. And so I asked my teacher, he said, oh, these were all the putting down of peasant rebellions in Central America, and there's not a lot of teaching about them or awareness about them. And it was place after place in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Mexico and Panama and I think Colombia, and you could probably help in Honduras, and you could probably help me fill in others, including the, and I learned a very important lesson that day that I otherwise wouldn't have learned if I hadn't gone to the primary source, which was this drum with its engravings. And by the way, now those engravings go far beyond the original circle. Now the engravings go all the way around at least 1.5 revolutions of the of this drum. But this was my introduction to these wars in mostly Central America. I wanted to tell this story because it was extremely important to my formation, my understanding of this country and the way it works. Thank you.
It's difficult to contain information and knowledge about the world in which we live, no matter how well the media is streamlined to do that, and how well there may be organizations that seek to disguise the interests.
You mean like the public education system?
Well certainly that, but also newspapers, radio and television. I mean, the way that they present things, it doesn't always, like the article I read before, when you get halfway down, you read that the Bolivian government wants a different government to silence people that are opposed to it, right? Which is kind of what Saudi Arabia did when they killed the journalist in Turkey, right? Turkey wouldn't shut him up, so we'll shut him up. I mean, that's, again, it almost becomes the norm. Maybe I should have presented how to read or how to watch. I would say there's a number of things that everybody can do. Number one, look at the sources. Look at who's quoted. I would say that if the U.S. supports the government, there will be more government people quoted. If the U.S. is opposed to the government, there will be more oppositional democratic voices recorded. Number two, look at the location. I always found it interesting when they would cover Israeli attacks in Palestine that the reporters were usually in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, not actually where they said the fighting was taking place, because that would be too... instead, they would rely upon the news people from... Same thing with the U.S. in the Mideast. Most reporters would go to the Pentagon and get the press statements from the press speaker for the Army or the Navy or the Joint Chiefs of Staff, never seeing the results, but just reporting on the policy. So check the sources. And you could probably win a few bets if you wanted to. Pick the country and say, I'll bet you there are more people in this article that are quoted that are favorable, that are government sources versus opposition sources, or vice versa. Check the location. Number three, look at the adjectives. Look at the appositive phrases, as they say in English grammar, right? So are they passive verbs? Are they active verbs? Are they weighted descriptions, right? So the military, General Calamar, that asked for the resignation of Morales is a recognized, well-respected general, right? The MAS senator that was excluded from is a MAS, is an indigenous a radical that got irate, right? In other words, you just set up with the appositive phrase whether this person is acceptable or not acceptable. And that's, you can learn that. The fourth thing I would say is look at the context. In most cases, it is hyper-personalized. So again, the article I showed you, it's all about Morales. Morales, Morales, Morales. Well, Mas got 58% of the vote. And you say the elections are over, you just took away the popular vote for 58% of the people that were in Senate, and we're going to have another election. It's not just about Morales. It's not just about Añez. Who cares if she's a baseball fan? What matters is that there's there are political forces, there are social interests beyond that individual, which is what's being done now with the impeachment of Trump. Let's look at Trump. Look what Trump did. Look what Trump did. Look what Trump did. Meanwhile, the environment. Meanwhile, there's intervention in Latin America. Meanwhile, there are trade deals. Meanwhile, the right. You just go on and on, which Congress, including the Democrats, are voting for, supporting, or not putting up any kind of alternative. So it's all about one man, which again is a lack of context. And I would say that means checking the hyper-personalization and discount that. What are the social interests? And then finally, a very short history of the policy. If you looked at the problems in Venezuela, not Maduro, but the problems in Venezuela, when do those begin and what happened in 2013, 2014, and the beginning of the U.S. sanctions and the drop of the oil price? Now you can begin to understand. But if it all started last week when inflation went skyrocket, you cannot possibly understand that. In other words, these four things will help you read the paper and watch the television news, and you can become a better citizen, I would argue.
Yeah, I was reading about the U.S. role in the coup, and I had read about Ivanka Trump. I think she went in September.
Yep.
Some of the things I read was that they brought down $400 million, and she came with 2,500 people. And I do know you're talking about Obama and that NDAA. I think one thing he did right before when he signed that, which was, I think, 2 days before Christmas,
yeah.
2016.
Yeah.
They lifted restrictions on using fake news in the U.S. on the U.S. population. One thing I had read, Bolivia has most of the world's lithium, I think 70%. And I think it was going to go to a Chinese company, and Bolivia was going to start plants to not just export lithium, but to develop it and make batteries in Bolivia, and started using it to benefit the people. It went from like 80% of the profits going to foreign corporations to the opposite, where 80% went to the Bolivian government and 20% went to foreign corporations.
There are many things that Stan was talking about I didn't raise at all, because the details are questionable, like you said. Like one of the things said that the general that asked Morales to suggested that he resign received $1 million and then he fled to the U.S. The only thing we know is he's in the U.S. But there's no, what do you call it, prima facie evidence for any of these direct interventions. And to me, that's kind of secondary. And you can get lost going down that rabbit hole about who said what to when. To me, the larger thing is there's no question that the United States was involved. And the United States does say that they were involved. So the question isn't so much, is it 10 million or is it 97 million like Eva Golinger says? I'm not going to get lost in that. It's because it still comes down to responding to the claims and responding to the challenges and basically defending the changes, the progress that was made in Bolivia against the charges, whether they were financed by the USAID or financed by some National Press Association or financed by another NGO. All of that's important in a historical sense, but in the immediate sense, it's that it happened and that it was not factually accurate, and there were different class interests at play. Everything you said about the media is right, the community media particularly. The book that I have here on the Pink Tide is about community media in Latin America, and there's wide variations. Venezuela has gone the farthest, so that Primero Negro, for instance, is a community radio station, but it reaches all of Caracas. It can reach 2 or 3 million people, which is different than the community radio stations we have in this country that has a 7-mile radius and they're 100 watts. their community radio stations have thousands of watts, can reach the population. They also have VBase TV and VTV, which are huge national reach television stations. So Venezuela is different. But what you said about Bolivia is true. And even though this was in the Constitution, it was like the question before about the environment. It's in the Constitution, but has it been enacted? There's kind of a slippage there. The big thing in Venezuela, I think, was that the changes that were made were pretty much initiated by organized sections of the population. So the aluminum factory gets nationalized because the people that work at the aluminum factory says it's ours. And now the government has to say yes or no. In some cases, there was divisions between the governor of a state and the labor unions in a state that wanted to nationalize something, and that created real problems for the Socialist Party of Venezuela and Maduro, because this is what the population wanted, but the bureaucrats and the PSUV in that particular state were blocking that. And that remains a problem, I would argue, in Venezuela. But the big difference is there is a much more public access to the media in Venezuela than there ever was in Bolivia, and that's certainly a problem. But I think that ultimately we can respond to this, and sometimes the response can be simply on the presentations that are made of the facts and the conditions that are made without necessarily knowing each of the details. Like I said, I have the NED site that said they spent about $1 million last year in Bolivia. I've read other things in Gray Zone and Golinger and others that say they've spent 10 times that. Well, I don't want to get into an argument over whether they spent $1 million or $10 million. The point is they were spending money. Here's where they admit that they're spending this money. These are what those organizations do. And that's a disruption to the democratic process in Bolivia, and ultimately it contributes to a coup. And that's what I think we have to speak to. It also depends upon who we're talking to. For the large population, it's like, where is Bolivia? Why was there a coup? What was the progress that was going on that prompted the venomous attitude towards? I mean, if you tell somebody that the president of this country thinks that the 2/3 of the population are Satanists and should go barefoot back to the Chaco, it's like, really? Is this somebody that you want to, or that she only got 4% of the vote, or her party only got 4% of the vote? That's pretty revealing right there. And those things aren't really disputed by any of the outlets. They don't emphasize those. But our task is to emphasize things that are important for social change, and in that process explain exactly what you did about Venezuela and its militia and why it's more difficult and some of the problems. But I don't want to go so far as to say, well, Morales didn't do enough, or MAS wasn't really a socialist group, or, as you know, MAS is restricting the environment and denying indigenous rights, all of these things that we need to speak to. I would just say that ultimately we have to say U.S. out of Bolivia. Let the Bolivians decide what's going to happen in Bolivia in collaboration with others. But the United States has to stop intervening. It's not in our interests. It's not in their interests. It's not in the interests of humanity. And we can all do that with everybody we see almost every day, not in an evangelical sense, but in the sense that organized conversations and providing them with information. I think I said before, anybody that would like the PowerPoint or some of these things that I gave out at the beginning, you can just email me at artz@purdue.edu. artz@purdue.edu. That's Purdue the university, not Purdue the chicken. And I will email you the PowerPoint for this presentation and the two little handouts that went with it on how to stage a coup, with the understanding you're not going to try to stage a coup. So thank you all. Thank you very much.
Before you go, talk about how to get the book.
I have a copy of The Pink Tide, which is about community media and politics in Latin America. That copy is not for sale, but anybody that wants a paperback copy, leave your address with Peter and $20, and I will mail it to you.